Hello, Yes But Why listeners. This is your host, Amy Jordan. Welcome to episode 225, my chat with Austin improviser Mark Major. But first, let's hear about those sponsors. This episode of Yes But Why podcast is sponsored by Audible. You can get your free audiobook download and your 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. In my conversation with Mark Major, he mentioned a series he worked on that was H.P. Lovecraft-inspired pieces. Plus, there's that HBO show everyone is talking about, so let's look up H.P. Lovecraft. Oh, wow, there's like 10 different versions of his complete works. Ooh, looks creepy. Love it. Audible is available for your iPhone, Android, or Kindle. Download your free audiobook today at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. This episode of Yes But Why is also sponsored by PodcastCadet.com. Swing on by PodcastCadet.com to get help for all your podcasting needs. From writing to producing to hosting, Podcast Cadet can help you improve your podcast. Go to PodcastCadet.com and put in offer code YBY20 to get 20% off your first consultation. This week on Yes But Why, I interview improvised theater artist Mark Major. In our conversation, we talk about narrative genre shows and immersive theater pieces. We discuss creative projects during COVID and how to trick your brain to avoid procrastination. Special shout out to Mark today, as his episode drop day, August 24th, is his birthday. Happy birthday, Mark! I now present to you episode 225. Mark Major shares creative lessons for making comedy. I'm Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why Podcast. Yeah.
When I was a little kid, I would do like magic shows and stuff for neighborhood kids and stuff. When I was a teenager or in high school or like college, I performed in the cast at a Rocky Horror Picture Show in Rochester and then Buffalo. And that lasted for too long. And then I sort of didn't really do anything. I took a theater class or two in college and then just sort of let it drop for a long time. It wasn't really a thing I was super into. I did a improv class here when I was 35 then. And I don't know, it just was a really fun, like easy way to get stuff out. And there was, it was all right. Like I was performing with my troupe regularly and doing like local shows, my shows and stuff. And it was like a lot of fun, but it wasn't just like, this is what I'm going to do. And somewhere along in there, I think there was a long form serial show way early on called the Great Mundane that like maybe 10 people have seen. I saw it early on and I was just like, man, cause it was, they did it for, I think 6 or 8 weeks. And it was one story that continued over the weeks and it was all improvised. And it was ridiculous. But I was like, man, that's like, you can do that. And then I started doing more narrative shows or genre shows. And those were really fun. And I really got interested in the idea of doing improvised theater that wasn't necessarily comedy. And finding those moments where it's like, oh, this is just a play. But we don't have a script. It doesn't always have to be comedy. And trying to find those, either those moments within shows or the whole shows themselves where we just like, hey, we're putting on a play and we don't even have to say it's improvised. And because, you know, some people don't believe it's improvised anyway. So why bother?
yeah, it's true.
Yeah. And I mean, we've literally done stuff where we up top, we're like, we make this up 100% top to bottom. And afterwards, you're like, yeah, but like you planned out this and that. I'm like, no, man, those are we're not lying. This isn't a magic show. yeah, so I think it was, I don't know if there was like a specific date or a show or a time that it like hit me. It was just kind of a slow burn of like, oh yeah, like we can do theater if that actually means something, and do it in a, you know, an improvised medium instead of you know, scripted. And there,
are you regularly doing that kind of theater now, or are you working on that, or were you working on that kind of thing?
So let's see. The last thing I directed / produced was last year, and we did a series of improvised H.P. Lovecraft inspired horror stories in a show. So each show was three separate stories, and we had a narrator for each one, and it was just a straight up horror. It was all improvised. And it was great. And it was, I did that show, pretty much the same show, maybe, gosh, almost 10 years ago, maybe? No, it couldn't be that long. And brought it back with a whole new cast. And it was great. And then the show before that, I performed in a couple that were also improvised drama. There was Shattered. That was directed by Peter Rogers and Nicole Bennett. And before that, we did the immersive improvised show. So we got a little warehouse space and made it up like a little haunted house. And it was heavily inspired by Sleep No More. It was called Speak No More, because I did it with my silent troupe, Golden. And we did this like 90-minute improvised family drama Elizabethan ghost story thing where we're all silent. We're performing in five different rooms and running between the rooms, and we can't even talk to like tell each other what's going on. And it worked amazing. It was so good. That's one of the best things I've been a part of. Everyone,
that sounds super fun.
Yeah. And just sort of like it's, and it's like going into it, like looking back at it, it's like, that is, if someone asked me to do that now, I would just be, that's impossible. You cannot do that. It's,
well, maybe not trying. Today. Maybe not right in the mid, right, not in the middle of COVID, but I betcha, yeah. I betcha those immersive shows are coming back. So.
we still have a box of those masks that we made people wear. So maybe. But it's just such a dumb idea, and it worked out so great. There's no reason it should have worked out as well as it did. And that's that feels like the sort of common experience I have. And there's like two sides of that. There's like the great side where it's like, I don't know, I've been doing this for long enough that I don't have anything to prove, and I'm not really afraid of anything on stage. I've done improvised shows where we're completely naked. I've done improvised shows where there's, you know, one person talking for an hour. We do silent shows all the time. So there's nothing really that I'm afraid of doing on stage. And also there's nothing that, I don't have to prove to anyone that I can do a thing. So it's just this really great freedom of like, yeah, this is a really stupid thing. It's a dumb idea, and there's no way it'll work. Let's go ahead and try it. And then it usually works out. Not usually. It often works out pretty well. And when it doesn't, it's gone and no one remembers it. It's great.
Have you always been that easygoing? Like as far as, you know, lack of fear? No, not so much.
Yeah. Yeah. It was definitely through just like the exposure of performing all sorts of different stuff. My first troupe out of our first class was called Improv for Evil. And, like we just did all sorts of insane, dumb stuff. And I think we broke a lot, like stuff that we had been told that we shouldn't do or couldn't do. Not in terms of like safety, but like in terms of like, oh, you can't do that with improv, or, oh, these rules, da 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 da. And we just did stuff. And just having, I feel spoiled because it was such a unique environment and experience to have that place where we can just try stuff. And at the time, like, you know, people were going to see improv, but not You know, we have performed for an audience of one or two lots of times. So there's a low bar. There's no pressure. And just being able to do that over and over again and try different things, seeing what works and what doesn't. And just like being on stage and just standing still and staring at the audience for 5 minutes. Like that's the most terrifying thing for a lot of people. And it doesn't bother me anymore.
Oh, I love that. That's my favorite. Like yeah. if I could extend the silent staring at the audience for as long as I possibly could. Oh, best.
Yeah, and that's one of my dirty secrets is that I'm really good at passing off not knowing what to do or say as a dramatic pause and being okay with that. So it's like, I have no idea what to do. I'll just sort of like stare meaningfully off to the side a little bit. And like, apparently it looks really good. It gives me a minute to think. So,
such a trick. Excellent trick. Yeah. I like it.
Maybe improvisers. Yeah, just really comfortable with not doing or saying anything.
Oh my God. I'm a recapper. I'm a where am I? What's going on? I start describing what's been happening. So since we've walked into this room, I've talked to this guy and just try to get myself where am I going? What's happening right now?
Yeah. there's so many, mostly newer people, but people of all levels, including myself sometimes, where you just get to a place where it's like, I got to do something. I'm going to keep talking or doing something or fidgeting and it's just meaningless noise to the audience. And man, if you can just slow down and not do anything, not say anything for a little bit too long, it just makes such a great impression, I think, when people are used to watching people just being frantic.
Yeah. That's a good way to meet new people too. If you meet new people, especially in a post show scenario, they want to say stuff to you. You don't have to say stuff, you know?
Yeah.
you just go yeah. And just smile thanks. Real big. That's oh, it. Wow. You know. I don't say much. Try not to give too much in that moment, especially in a post-show scenario, you know, where you're I'm super pooped, but I am very supportive of you supporting me. Oh, man. Hey, can I jump back? You said when you were a kid you did Rocky Horror. Now, I didn't find Rocky Horror until I was an adult, and that's probably my parents' good fortune, but how did you get involved with that? I've only known a handful of people that did it, and I'm always envious. I've never, don't tell anyone, but I've never gone. Okay. I know it's terrible, and once COVID's over, you'll drag me to one, and I'm fine with that. But what I'm saying is, how did you get involved? What was the scene like?
When I was a kid, my dad had a record, an album of the soundtrack. And my sister and I would play it all the time, because we thought it was ridiculous. And being pretty young, didn't know anything about what anything was. And I think it was in a movie too. It was in Fame or something where they went to see it and it was that looks like a fun thing. It was mid high school, I think. I think my dad actually took me to it. I don't remember if I asked him or if he was we're going. And we went, it took me two or three times, I think. And then I started going by myself later on. And yeah, it's weird because it's the same. It was in Rochester. And it's the same group of weirdos that, same 20, 30, 40 people that go every week. And so when you start going more than a couple times, you start to get to know people. And then eventually people rotate out of the cast performing it in front of the movie. And they're like, hey, we know you. You want to do a thing? And it just sort of happened. It was a lot of fun. It's a really low pressure, low stakes environment because you're in a dark movie theater. There's no stage lights on you. Everyone there is there often, or at least know what they're getting into. So like people running around in fishnet stockings and doing dumb stuff is not it's not a problem. And everyone's gonna be like, oh, I got it. You know, it's like, no, that's what we're here to see. Yeah. And then like the repetition is like, it just becomes, I don't know how to describe it. You just do this thing over and over and over again until
like church. Like,
yeah. I breathe and do this. It's just my ritual. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a ritual for sure. Did you like make friends with the people? Like, was it your crowd? Yeah. Did you like hang out in high school?
Yeah. After I went to college in Buffalo and joined the cast there. And I'm still friends with some of the people who are in the cast, at least one or two. One of them is a lawyer in New York now. And we're like Facebook friends and talking to all the time. And that was 30 years ago, about 30 years ago. Yep. So, yeah.
Man, I think about that movie when I like saw it and then was like, wait, I'm sorry, what? Large groups of people collect and watch this movie together? What? Like, yeah. I don't.
It was such like an interesting kind of formative time too. Cause like as a high schooler in upstate New York, you know, there are not a lot of gay people. There's not a lot of people who aren't white.
Sure. But
just being in that environment and being exposed to like, oh yeah, like all the stuff. And just having it be like, yeah, this is just how it is. Was a real interesting, like then going out into the real world where people, you know, and this was, you know, 1990-ish. So people are starting to come around a little bit, but there's still a lot of people who have a lot of problems with anything that's not heteronormative.
Oh, yeah. I don't think Rocky Horror would do well if it came out right now.
Yeah.
Like, I think people would be like, you know what? I don't think so. Be like, hmm.
Okay. Yeah. So it's just a nice environment to be like, yeah, like this is all stuff I see all the time. I don't know why anyone would have a problem with any of it.
yeah, right. Seems fine to me. I don't know what the problem is. It is interesting too, like, cause your dad got you into it. Like A, it says a lot about your dad in a cool way. Like, it's like, yeah. Cool. Your dad's my friend now. But like also, you know, like he was into it and welcoming to that situation, so like you would immediately be as well. You're like, great, okay, so my dad's into it, what's this? Oh, okay. Yeah. So like cool. When later people are like, that's weird, you're like, I don't get that, you know, because I had parents like that too. And when I got older and I was like, I'm confused why you're mad, like my mom right. says it's fine, she's the top, so what's the problem, right?
Yeah, a lot of people's biases just don't hold up under any sort of, like, explain to me why gay marriage is wrong. Like, you don't have any good reasons. Even if you don't like it, you can't explain besides just, like, I don't like it.
Right? Yeah. Also, like, are you seriously watching this movie like it's a documentary? Are you kidding me right now? Come on. Clearly, it's a romp. Get into it. Like, have you ever seen a musical? Oh, you haven't, have you? Oh, I'm so sorry.
No. That was one of the first musicals I ever, like, I'm sure I saw musicals before, but that was the first one where I was like, oh, like, into this.
Yeah. Good songs.
In the college, too. But that was about it. Yeah.
Nobody ever made you watch Guys and Dolls or Oklahoma or anything?
No, not really. I think I kind of, like, missed that. Bless I mean, there you. Was, like, you know, Grease and, sure. you know, movie musicals. But yeah, I didn't like really do like musicals until I like came around and started doing theater stuff again much later.
Yeah. And now it's like improvised musicals, which is way crazier.
It's so improvised musicals. So here's the other dirty secret, one of many. Improvised singing is the easiest. It's easy. If you know how to improv, you can improvise singing. You just talk, only you talk with a musical tone. and then you have a great musical improviser to play along with you. And it's super simple to do once you get over the, like, oh my God, I'm singing. And people in the audience lose their shit because they're like, how can you possibly do that? It's impossible. You can't come up with a song with a super simple chorus. It's like two words that you just repeat over and over again. And then you did it again later. How did you do that? It's a magic. It's the easiest thing.
I love that.
And super fun to do. Your singing is fun. I just love hearing people just like, oh my God, I can't believe like the two of them, like, sang the same chorus at the same time or whatever. It's like, I know, because we make it. It's tricks. It's all tricks. It's all magic tricks.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. Like we were talking earlier about little ways to like tell people, like when you look down and you're like, I don't know what I should do right now, so I'm going to take this dramatic pause. When I did this improv musical, we used to when I do improv, I can keep track of time. But when I did improv musicals, I couldn't. Okay. Like I time would pass in a different way. And so there would always be one of us in the group that would be in charge of staying on track with the time. And we had this thing where that person's job was to mention anything at all that is French. And that would let us know it's time to sing the final song. So that was our way. Like, it was just our little communication between us that, like, they'd just be like, man, I could go for some French fries right now. And we're like, cool, last song, you got it. Like, or he'd be like, or they'd do some sort of like, I could handle it. Like, does anyone have a croissant? And you're like, oh, okay, French, I got it. All right. You know, it'd just be little things. No one would ever notice. It would go with whatever we were talking about, but it would like get us all on point together and like, oh, what? Yep. Okay, cool. Great. Let's sing a big final number. Oh man, those are fun though. I love that kind of thing. You know, it's funny you say, I love how you're like, dirty secret, improv singing is easy. Says the same guy who is like, but I'd be cool standing on a stage and saying nothing, which I think says that you have some, you know, stage presence and comfortability when you're on stage. You know, if you have those things, of course, improv singing's easy.
But that just came from like doing it badly for a long time. And again, like, I think we were super spoiled. Like, I started doing improv here in like 2005. And like the first 5 years or so, like that I was doing it, again, like the community was relatively small. The audience was relatively small and you could get away with doing whatever you wanted as badly as you wanted. So we were very spoiled in that we didn't have to put audience in seats. Really, we could do a really, really bad musical. We could do anything. Oh man, the worst improv I've ever seen. I still have on my YouTube channel. It's a narrative duo that me and my friend Nadine did like a year after we started doing improv. There was a troupe here called Get Up with Shannon McCormick and Shana Merlin, and they would do improvised narratives. And we're like, we can do that. So we had like two rehearsals and we decided we were going to do that. And it is the most painful 20 minutes you'll ever, ever see. It's the worst thing I've ever been a part of and ever seen. And rage, because now I have people like, you know, saying, oh, you're good, whatever. I'm just like, no, 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 you don't understand. You have been doing improv for 6 months now. And you were way better than I was after like 5 years.
Come on.
It just took, I feel like it took me a longer time, which may, you know, explain like the sort of resilience or whatever. Just like it was a slower cook. I'm more of a brisket than a French fry.
What kept you going back though? What kept you going even though you felt like it wasn't connecting?
I don't know. It was mostly the people I was hanging out with, I think. We just get together and do your dumb stuff and, you know, put on the best show we could, which was usually not super great, but eventually got better and better and better. And yeah, I like to point back and when people feel like they're like, oh, like I had my first main stage show and I didn't do a good job or, you know, I got kicked out of the troupe or whatever. I'm like, look, I'm going to send you a link to a YouTube video that you can look at. and you will know that you are 100 times better than that. So don't feel bad, or feel how you want to feel. Your feelings are valid, but don't despair, because you are already way better than I was for a long time. So keep at it, kids.
I like the idea that you're just spreading. You're like trying to get views on this YouTube video. And oh, no. So like, you're like, let me show you this terrible. It's called like, you should rename it to like worst improv scene ever. And then you get a lot of views on that. True. A lot of people watching that. You're like, watch out for the chicken. And it's like, what? And they'll watch all the way to the end, waiting for some chicken.
Yeah, at one point, like we were in the middle of the show, in the middle of a scene, like, I think it was Nadine, which is like backing off stage until we're like, we're doing the scene off stage because neither of us wants to be there. And it was great. It's so good.
I teach a lot of level ones, and I've seen quite a few. I'm going to back off stage and try to get out of here. And I'm usually yelling from the audience. No, you don't end the scene. Someone else does.
Put your toes on the edge of the stage. Come on.
I don't care if you have nothing else to say. Keep talking.
You don't have to say anything. It's a great thing. You don't have to be funny. You don't have to be clever. You don't have to be fast. You don't, literally don't have to say anything. Just be cool.
How did you get... So, like, you started out doing the community was the Hideout, correct? That's where you started taking classes?
I started taking classes at the Hideout. The community at the time was the Austin Improv community, which was, you know, like 40 people.
It was like, which was kind of consisted of like the Hideout and Cold Town, maybe Institution at that point. Shayna.
Institution was around way back. Shayna was around.
Yeah.
Institution hadn't come around yet.
Oh, no. Okay.
And we would actually get paid for shows, but because we would split the door, but we would, you know, each troupe would get like $1.50. But that way the community worked was like, yeah, you get a cut of the door. It's like a dollar. The new folks bought the Hideout and it became that. And yeah, there's a lot of community based around that too. That was my primary venue.
Right on. So when you started though, you did the basic comedy improv, right? Looking for game and whatnot. What led you, was it just the changeover of the Hideout crowd that led you into the sort of improvised dramas and improvised genre pieces, or were you into that and you like sought it out?
Yeah, I definitely was pushing people to do that from the get-go. I'm also a gamer. I play a lot of tabletop role-playing games.
Oh, awesome.
And the games I was into and still am into at the time are less like D&D fighting monster stuff and more like let's write sad things on index cards and talk about our character's feelings stuff. and like LARPing along that lines too. So there's a lot of like, oh, like we can do this sort of like dramatic story generation at the table. I want to see if we can do it live in front of an audience. It turns out you can. Because it's basically the same thing. Improv is just role-playing, standing up with no dice, usually.
Usually.
They're basically the same thing. Yeah. The only difference between LARPing and improv is that you get an audience for one of them.
And for LARPing, I find that there's a bit more like costume and props and like
tons of costume and props for a lot of improv shows.
Oh, I guess you're right. I guess you're right. Yeah.
Swords I made. Yeah. Made a dozen swords for the Conan show I directed. Just like, and taught people stage combat and got all the costume. Yeah. It's prop and costume heavy, which sometimes it's great because it makes it more theatrical. Also, it can be leaned on, I think. To make up for not great improv, which, you know, happens regardless, but
sure.
Yeah. Try to make everything as good as possible and then not care about it.
Yeah, I hear that. I did that with a sketch show for a while. It was like, okay, we all just wrote amazing scenes. Now let's see if the actors learn the lines. Who knows? You know, so yeah, there's definitely something about, I like to say, you know, if you want to do live performance, you better be fine with chaos and, and like putting your heart and soul into it and then accepting chaos back. Like, okay, cool. Man, so how did you originally get into the idea of the improvised? Oh, was it from the RPG games that you had going?
It was a bit of both. It was, you know, some from like these more dramatic or character driven style role playing games, and some from just like I said, catching those bits of theater in whatever we're doing, and being like, oh, like we could do more of this. And we could do it on purpose. And we could just do a play instead of comedy improv.
Right.
Which is fun. And just sort of like, I don't know, I feel like I'm always the kind of person who finds the like the weird thing that other people don't really want to do and like desperately try to get other people to do it.
I feel like
everyone's just like, oh, I'm just here to have fun. I'm just, you know, telling jokes and making boop-a-doops. I'm like, no, let's talk about our feelings and expose our dark secrets. And, you know, like, it takes a certain kind of performer to be into that from the improv comedy world.
Sure, sure. You know, we all come at it from different points of view, right? I dig the... Yeah. The lots of detail and developing the characters. I'm like, oh, I want to play that role playing game where I just develop a character and don't have to do anything. Yeah. I'm into it.
I have so many recommendations. That'll be another hour.
They're right up the same alley, though. I mean, as far as developing, you know, sort of a world, a cohesive world in an improvised, you know, genre show, for sure. I mean, if you're going to get a bunch of people to make sense in this, you know, one night play, even if it's thematic, you know, you have to be able to quickly communicate, I'm this person and this is how I feel and this is what's going to happen.
This is my deal. Boom.
Yeah, totally. Totally. When I teach, I mentioned earlier that I teach a summer camp. Now, this year was all online and just me teaching by myself. But years past, it's been I'm teaching comedy some of the day. But then there's other people who I get to like kind of curate what their other lessons of the day are, and I will ask for certain things to help develop what we're trying to do. So there was a guy, maybe you know him actually, his name Ben Sterling, who he would teach Commedia dell'arte to the kids. Just knowing the sort of tropes and the characters really helped when I was like, okay guys, let's write this scene about, you know, these characters, what's going to happen, and then they give me a vague idea, and then I'd be able to assign different characters to the ideas that Ben had given them in the morning, and that would help us write the thing. Be like, you know how we were talking about that guy who's the villain? Okay, this character we're writing, they're going to be the villain. You know, so it really helped. Like, sort of the interdisciplinary nature of that. Like, this is the idea of these trope characters is something we've been doing for thousands of years. Like, we can do it. Just give them a different name. It's all the same. This one's a lover. Mm-hmm. This one's a fighter. This one's mad about everything. Great. Yeah. Got it.
Just having to pull out of your pocket. Like, I've done some stuff where I've taught some comedia to some of my troops and be like, cool. Like, we'll just have two people do a scene. Pick a random character and, you know, see what works. And it always works. Even like we got two Capitanos, like, it's great. It's hilarious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it feels not only like a structure that you can handle, but when there's sort of historical context to it, I mean, I don't know about you. I went to a college that was like all about the classical theater stuff, you know? So Commedia was like number one, right? They were all about it. And so there's just something comforting, I think, to imagine that, like, not millions, but like hundreds of thousands of years ago, there are people putting on these plays, just winging it, just like we are. I love it.
And I think there's a certain, like, I don't know, I think there's a lot of kind of imposter syndrome amongst all artists, but improvisers and actors as well. And, like, there's a difference between coming up with a character, you know, fully fleshed out on spot, however well, or just picking something that someone else already made, another archetype, or even something that someone wrote down, like audience suggestion. Like, that's half of why we take suggestions. You, it's not your fault anymore. And like, if you have to, if you're making up a character, you can feel like, oh no, did I make the right choice? Did I, is this dumb? I don't know. Am I, I'm the worst ever. But you can do the exact same thing and just pick, you know, an arbitrary character that someone else came up with before, whether it's a comedic character or whatever. And then automatically like, oh yeah, this is solid because someone else did it or it's already existing. And like, you feel less like it's your dumb choice. And people, I feel like people like get a lot of confidence from that. I think a lot of the like the journey to becoming a good improviser is maybe not necessarily feeling, but like understanding that your choices are just as solid and you can be as confident with those as something someone made up with thousands of years ago.
Yeah, totally. I have a sort of similar personal confidence on stage, so I never. People always talk about imposter syndrome. I've started feeling it since I've been home because I'm not doing as much. But when I stay busy, I don't think about it at all. Because
there's no time to think about.
And also, like, I'm not an imposter. I'm doing this. Are you doing this? No, you're not? Great. I'm in. Like, okay. Like, when people are like, oh, but I'm not famous. And I was like, yeah, that guy didn't work all last year. I did. Like, great. I'm super glad he's famous. I hope it works out for him. But that's not what I want. You know, I talk to my friends who like legitimately went to like film school and are like trying to be actors and they haven't performed at all. Like they're in LA. They haven't done anything in, you know, I haven't done anything in 6 months. What?
The stakes are too high. Like, you're doing this for a living, or you're doing this to become famous or impress someone, and the stakes are high, and that like automatically makes you seize up.
Yeah.
You have to kind of throw, even if the stakes are high, you have to kind of throw it away, which is really hard. It's way easier said than done.
Or like in the case of there being a community, which now the current community, you know, COVID shutdown aside, the community of Austin has a lot of opportunities, but there's still way more people than there are opportunities. So I'm sure there's plenty of people who are like, oh, I wish I could do this show, but I didn't get cast in it. I'm not the kind of person who goes, oh, that's sad that you didn't cast me. I'm not going to do anything now. I'm like, cool. I wanted to do that thing that you wanted to do. And now I'm not in your thing. So I'm going to find a way to do it myself.
Yeah. And that's exactly like the last couple of things we did, like we didn't do with the theater. I was like, I'm going to do the show. I'm not going to wait for someone to tell me it's okay to do it.
Yeah.
Even though, I have a good relationship and track record. So I could probably go to a theater and be like, hey, I want to do the show or I want to be in the show. I'm like, I'm not going to wait for someone to tell me that I'm allowed to do this show or waiting for someone to put me on a schedule or, give me space. I'm like, I'm going to get people. I'm going to maybe do a Kickstarter to get some money. I'm going to rent a space. I'm going to hold auditions. I'm going to make a show happen. Great. And that's, I don't think people do this on purpose, but there is definitely a scarcity mindset to a lot of people. I know most of the people who are responsible for a lot of schools and whatnot do not like actively advocate against that scarcity mindset.
What do you mean the scarcity mindset? I don't know that I understand what you mean.
So like if you're a student and you finish all the levels and you're like, cool, I want to do shows. There's 50 other people who graduated near you and there's, six slots in a main stage show. And I think people feel like they have to fight or like socially climb or do something outrageous or whatever to like be noticed or get that spot. And like in the grand scheme of thing, like getting a slot in a main stage improv show is like the lowest stake. Like you're not getting paid. You're not getting famous. 100 people are going to see you. But like it's a small tight knit community. So like the stakes are personally high because you've made these bonds with these people and you want to, you want to be in front of people. You want to get your chance to be on stage. You want to show off to your friends and family. There's a lot of reasons.
Yeah. Plus there's a certain level of like climbing a ladder within the community that you feel like you have to do when you first get into it.
Yeah, and I know that, you know, I've you know, spoken and listened to a lot of, you know, theater owners and school owners and stuff. They're like, please go do your own stuff. You don't have to do that. But it's just because people are people. And there's that scarcity mindset. People feel like they have to scrabble. And like, if someone doesn't give them a slot in the schedule or someone doesn't cast in the show, they feel like they're not good enough to do their thing, or they're not allowed to do their, like the worst, like they're, if someone else doesn't give me time on the schedule, I can't do my show or my troupe can't perform. And that's a bunch of,
yeah.
Go to a coffee shop, go to a bar, go to the street, you know, like rent a space, put on the show you want. There, no one can tell you not to do a thing, or they can, but you don't have to listen to them. You do what you like.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no like theater police. Like there really isn't anyone that will stop you doing something if you want to make it happen on your own. I get the idea that not everybody's like a show organizer though. Like some people there's a huge part of, you know, the population of performers that will wait for somebody else to give them an opportunity. I feel like that's a lot of people, not just in Austin, like across the board.
So,
idea of like putting yourself out there and doing your own thing seems so like, you know, like a frightening prospect. I'm here to tell anyone that's listening, the specter of getting in trouble for doing something is gone. Chris True is not around anymore. He used to tell us not to do stuff all the time, but he was the only one in the whole community that ever had rules like that, ever.
That guy on this podcast, fuck that guy.
Yeah, you can say fuck that guy. Oh my God. Absolutely. Yeah. But like that was the only scenario. Like I thought that too, but in my initial experience there was sort of a gatekeeper, right? But I'm here to tell you guys, since I've been around, it turns out there isn't a gatekeeper. And to the point of anything, like you could go to any one of the other improv theaters and pitch your show. Like that's the other thing too. Yeah. Maybe the entire cast is people that like are from Hideout. Maybe the whole show was conceived after a workshop done at the Hideout, but that doesn't mean that every other theater might not be like, yeah, sure. We'll take that. We'll put that on our roster and any kinds of space or whatnot. The other thing too, to think about when you're trying to produce your own show is like, who's looking for this? Like you don't have, if you go to an improv theater, sometimes that's already fill up. Those people are not interested right now. Go somewhere where they're going to be like, what is this? This is wild. I don't understand. What?
Like the, one of the sort of realizations that a lot of people have made, it's just like, you know, we have or had, have, we still have, they're around. You know, there's say four improv theaters in town. They can fill, say, you know, 50 seats a night or 100 seats a night, say, say optimistically any given, you know, weekend night. But if they completely sell out, pack extra people in, there'll be 500 people seeing improv. There's a million people in Austin. Like you're not, your competition is not other improv theaters or the audience. You're not trying to get the audiences going there. You want people who are, you know, are, would stay home and watch Netflix or, you know, do whatever. If you can't get, you know, any of the other 999,950 people out to your show, it's not anyone else's fault.
Well, think about, we were talking earlier that you and I both did Dinner Detective, a totally random, very campy, ridiculous show. That's essentially what we're talking about. It was an improvised basic. We knew what happened, but you know, we didn't really know all the things that were going to go on during the course of the evening. We played it out. How many people after the show were like, I didn't even know they did improv in Austin? You're like, are you kidding me? You know what I mean? Right. Like the people that came to that show were just a different group of people. People that would never have Googled improv in Austin, right? Yeah, but yet they came to a show and experienced it, had a great time, thought they had the, oh my goodness, it's so wonderful. Like, guys, that was at the Marriott. The Marriott would not mind renting you that room. They're fine with it.
Anyone can do it. Yeah. And there is, you know, there is a sort of privilege barrier of like, you need to have enough money to put up for a space. You need to have enough free time, you know, that you're not working or taking care of kids, that you can organize those stuff. There are a lot of barriers that are not related to theater. But
Sure. I mean, but that's like anything. If you're interested in doing something, no matter what it is, whether it's producing a play, writing a novel, learning how to weld, like you're going to find the moments in your day to get it done. And yeah. The unfortunate part is no skill is going to come to you by you thinking about how you'd like to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so you gotta do it. You gotta figure it out. And you got to navigate, like, thankfully, like, I like talking to you right now because, like, both of us have had experiences producing in this city and then outside of the city where it's like, you know, I've done random different things. I worked for a theater. I was an intern at a theater in Portland, Maine. And it was like a thing where I was the assistant director of two of the shows of their season, two of the shows out of the full year, which meant all the rest of the time I had a lot of free time. So anytime I had free time, I was like, is there an open space I could use? And they said, yeah, here, use this space. And I put up two different plays because I was just bored and other people were too. It was like, hey, man, you're not in this next play. You want to do this monologue with me? And he's like, yeah,
go for it.
You know, like, great.
Austin there. COVID aside, like if you want a 20 minute play, like there's like the Frontera Fest every year. And like literally all you have to do is say, I want to do a thing and you get a spot. There's lots of things like that where if you want to do a thing, it's, even if there are barriers, like those barriers are very low. Look for festivals, look for people who have empty space, collaborate with people.
Oh my God, festivals. You're right. There's so much of that. Even not COVID aside, do you know how many online festivals there are right now? Oh my God. If you were like, I can't afford a plane ticket, but I bet you can get on Zoom. Come on.
Yeah. I'm doing a show in a festival in New York that I couldn't make otherwise.
Right.
And later on this month, I'm like, oh yeah, cool. I don't have to leave my house.
Yeah.
Great.
Awesome.
And like this, you're absolutely right. Like this, talking about like removing barriers, you don't have to rent a space anymore. You don't have to get approval from a theater or an artistic director. No. You don't have to, rent it by anyone. Yeah. Like the only limitation is you having a computer and a network connection. And like you can do as good or better of a show than many, many, many people are doing right now. Or teach classes. You can teach classes online. You don't need to do anything besides like tell people about what you know.
Yeah, right.
Talk to Jill Bernard. She'll be the first person to tell you like every person is their own improv school. So if you always wanted to be an improv teacher but haven't been able to get to be a TA at your school of choice, like fuck it. Put together a syllabus and invite some people to do a free class. Or if you want to get some people together, do a show. I have a script reading group. We just like do table reads of scripts. It's like a little show for ourselves. You could do that for other people.
Awesome.
You can do as good or better of a show than anyone in the world is doing right now. There's no barriers except for doing it. So,
right. Yeah. And, I've noticed a lot of like, watching a lot of the Zoom stuff, like not just our internal, like Austin or improv Zoom stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, like the Parks and Rec Zoom special and like the SNL done on Zoom. Y'all, we're all figuring this out one by one. They weren't great, right? We know that. Yeah, like somebody wanted to throw some makeup on half of those Parks and Rec people, but they didn't, right? But that's okay. That's what they really look like. I'm so sorry you had to find out now, but that's it, right?
What was it? It wasn't a Shakespeare play. It was a Greek play. Anyway, it was like professional actors, big theater over Zoom, and it was like, okay. I've seen some amazing stuff. So you know the Rude Mex in town here? They have a play called Method Gun that I never got to see. A student group in a Wesleyan college did a production of it over, and they had to switch to doing it over Zoom halfway through the process. And it is the best thing I've seen so far. They were so amazing. The performances were great. The way they used the medium was great.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was like, bawling halfway through it is amazing.
You know, that's a good point, using the way to use the medium. Like, that's another thing of, like, if you're sort of hitting a wall with, like, stuff that you were doing, if, like, when COVID hit, you were like, oh, man, I don't know what I'm going to do. I've exhausted all the things I wanted to do. Well, here's a brand new medium that needs to be worked with. And
yeah, you have a lot of new limitations now, and that is the best way to get yourself going. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like, I watched a lot of stuff, because both for, you know, reasons and for, I'm on the BIPAC committee, so I have to watch a lot of stuff. I've seen some stuff where people are like really, really, really making good use of the medium, because it's, you know, you're not on a stage anymore and you're not performing for a television camera and you're not doing a web series. Like, you, this is a new thing. And I've seen a lot of really great things and a lot of things where it's just like, we're going to do the same thing, only, you know, sitting down with a Zoom background. And it's like, oh, I'm glad you're doing your thing. But like, the people who are like really using the new medium, and I don't think we've even scratched the surface of what we're, because we're forced to do this now. So I think people, and it's not going to be people we expect, it's going to be people coming out of nowhere who are doing something off the wall, amazing.
Yeah, right. I mean, because you see people making these friggin' TikTok masterpieces, and then like back in the day, like remember when they did like Cloverfield, and it was all the handheld cameras, and everyone was like, "Oh my god, I can't even handle it." It's like just a different way of doing stuff, man. Mm-hmm. I mean, right now I'm working on, I don't even know if I should call it a web series or what, but like a web series with a couple of friends of mine from a local theater, where like they wrote it specifically with the idea that we would all film our stuff separately. Mm-hmm. So like we all film our own thing separately and then they're editing it together. So it's like super interesting how that's a different sort of medium, and figuring it out, like we're all in different spots, but they've figured out a way to arrange it so that it's not like super terrible that we're in different spots, you know? So
yeah, and a lot of, everyone's like using their house as a background, and like there's ways to incorporate that. Like don't hide it. Like use the fact that you are invisibly in different spaces to do something. Yeah, it's there's so many limitations that you can use for great effect, I think. And I don't even know where to begin.
Plus, if you're like deep into celebrity worship, watching them do Zoom is hilarious. Because no one is there, not unless they're improvisers. Like, sure, you see, like Amy Poehler did great. She's fine. You know, she's all right. She can handle it. But like the rest people trying to figure out what they're doing, how this works, what's going on. And like I've been watching like interviews, you know, and you like see their room and you're like, what's that room like? What's happening? Like, you're like, what are the books behind Tom Hanks' head? What is that book? I need to know.
Oh, Dianetics. Okay.
You know, yeah, exactly. Exactly. Oh, 6 copies of Dianetics. Oh, okay, cool. I get it. You know, but, but you know, it's just little things like that where you're like, what is she drinking Chardonnay right now? What's going on? Hoda, you are on point. Like whatever ridiculous, fun little details that we can now glean from one another. It's really even the playing field too. I mean, earlier we were talking about like, oh, this famous person versus, you know, like this actor, whatever. But now it really is the same. I mean, like it's even the playing field to the point where like I've seen little Zoom at their own home shot movies with famous people. Mm-hmm. Where like they're making little scenes with their friends. And it's like, yes, yes.
Have you seen the fight choreographer movies that have gone around, right? Where like each fight choreographer like does, like punches the camera or whatever, and then the next person do it and comes back.
Yes. They're great. There's,
and like, yeah, like stuff like that. Like no one would have ever done that before. They had to. And that's like, it's amazing. It's so great.
Yeah.
Can't wait to see what happens.
There's also something really great about a moment of boredom. I was actually bemoaning a lack of boredom. Sometimes I worry that it was these thoughts that I had that caused us into this thing. But I was bemoaning the lack of boredom for myself and for everyone, that there was just too much available for us all the time that I was never going to get to the point that I needed to get to really come up with a new idea or do something new. And boy, howdy, did I get it. I got a lot of staring. Now there's a lot of like, oh my God, what am I going to do with my day? Okay. The same thing. Great, great. I love it. Super fun. Plus, I have a toddler now who likes to watch the same movie every day. So there's a lot of that. There's a lot of like zoning as that's going on. And then coming back, oh yeah, look at him. Okay.
Are you at the museum again? Yep.
Oh, he's going to fall. Oh, look, they saved him. Yeah. Who knew? Oh, boy. Yeah. It's interesting how, you know, this moment, I'm trying to, you know, soak up as much as I can for its creative helpfulness. Like, what new ideas do I have? What new views of the world? What new ways can I communicate this? What do you think for you has been the thing that you're taking away? And this is kind of off the cuff, but like, it's okay if you don't have an answer. Is there any sort of creative lessons you're taking away from this time?
Yeah. In the before times, I really kept myself really busy. And I was like, man, if I just had like a month of free time, I could like knock this project out or do this or whatever. And now I have all the time in the world. And I find that it does not help with being productive. I'm working on a podcast with some folks right now, doing some writing. I'm just like, I have all day, every day to write, and I am not. and it's just like, it's not the, like, going forward, when things change however they will, like, it's not the lack of free time, I think, that necessarily keeps you from doing stuff. In fact, every time I've like been unemployed or between contracts or whatever, I'm like, oh, I have a month to do this thing that I want to do, and I always wind up not doing it. But when I'm like doing two shows and working full time, I'm like, oh, I'm like, somehow I, you know, wrote this book or whatever. And I don't know, it doesn't feel like either side is necessarily super healthy, but it's just an observation that I'm sort of like noticing. Like, it's not lack of time that is keeping me from doing things. It is something else, and I haven't figured out what it is.
I'm of two thoughts about this. One, I feel like sometimes there are ideas for projects in our head that are not actual ideas for projects, but rather they are just good brainstorming fodder, and they help us develop other ideas. Yeah. So I've had this one screenplay that I wrote. This screenplay, it wasn't great. It was like a first draft. You know how it goes. And I was trying to figure out how to revamp it. How do I change this? What do I do? The brainstorming that I do, I've never rewritten it, okay? But the brainstorming that I do about how to rewrite it has formed three or four other stories.
Right.
Because of just the nature in which I'll start pulling the ideas out. Well, what about this? What about this? What about this? What about this? And then I'm like, ooh, this is interesting. And I go down this other path with a different character and a different thing altogether. But it's just sort of like, so I kind of think like some ideas aren't meant to happen. They're there to keep your brain crunching and moving around and thinking of stuff. But that story, that character will never truly come to life in the same way that others will. It doesn't make them less than. It's just that. And then the other thing is, I've been watching, spending time at home a lot. We got this like app that's called Great Courses on our TV, and we've been learning stuff. And one of the things that we learned about was about the way your brain works, and it was about motivation and getting projects done. And it was like, your brain is naturally going to procrastinate. Like, it's got 1,000 things going on. Don't beat yourself up. Like, that's what it's going to do. But if you really want to do something, the first thing you need to do is stop doing anything. Like, if you want to work on a project, as opposed to like, okay, I just got home from work, now I'm going to sit down and write the novel. Okay. The guy, the neuroscientist who's teaching this course, says you should come home, sit for 20 minutes, not do anything, just think about the project you want to do, and then after 20 minutes, start working. That 20 minutes of downtime in which you let your brain relax and also formulate what it's going to do and plan and stuff like that will actually be better for you. And that, like, a lot of times we think that what we should do is just like go, 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 go. But he suggests that the brain needs like a prep time where you're like, hey, brain, okay, we're going to do this project. And I know that you want to make me not do it because we've been procrastinating on this one for 6 months. But today we're going to do it. And we're going to do it. Today's the day because of this. I think of it when he tells the story, it made me think of, you know, like improv scenes where you're like, today's the day. I'm like, okay, guys, what's today? Why are we having this conversation? Today's the day she needed to tell you this. Why? Why is today the day? Right.
Yeah.
And that makes me think, you know, like, so that's how, so in my mind, I think it's sort of like priming your brain to suddenly be like, you know what? Today is the day. I'm getting it done. I'm going to be the best at this. It's going to go great. And it's like ridiculous. And the guy's like, listen, I get that you're probably laughing at me and saying like, I'm not going to trick my brain into doing it. If I don't want to do it, I'm not going to do it. And that's the other thing I think, by the way, is if you don't want to do it, you're not going to do it. But the neuroscientist says, if you think about it long enough, you can make yourself do it. So I thought, hey, this guy's pretty good. He's a scientist. I should probably listen to him.
Language of like, I'm going to trick my brain into this, as if your brain is something that is separate from you. Like that language is always just like really, really interesting to me. Like, it's not I'm tricking myself. Like, I'm tricking this other thing that somehow makes me do things. It's a like. It's
I know it like sounds crazy, but like the whole lesson that this thing was that I was watching was literally about the things that we feel are logical, common sense ways our brain should work, and how our brains work the opposite way.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, and I was like, what? You know, different. I forget one of the other ones, but I was just like so mad when he was like, actually, this happens. And I was like, oh, no, because my common sense wanted it to be true.
I'm kind of the mind that there is not a single brain. You don't have a single mind. Like, there's 100 competing brains in your brain that are all trying to do different things. And whichever one like comes to the surface at any time is the one that you're like, think is yourself. And that sounds crazy out loud, but like I think like how like neural I don't want to say networks because that's a different thing, but like that's actually turned out like how a lot of stuff works. Like, there's a lot of competing people in your head
that,
you know, you sort of synthesize into who you are at the moment. And so like you do kind of have to trick things into doing things. You can, like, when you're doing like mask work or something on stage or whatever, like there's a lot of like, oh, like that is, I've definitely had moments where I like had a strong character or a mask character on stage, and like they are separate from me, and they are doing and saying a thing, and I'm in my brain like watching it going like, oh no, why would you do that? It was really like interesting, that sort of like separation of mind of like, of course, like I'm not schizoid or whatever. Like, I'm a person with a coherent identity, but just the thinking about like the way, like these different like sort of like subroutines, I guess, in your brain sort of like fight for dominance and wrestle with each other. And
well, it makes me think of what you were saying earlier about like costumes, like some things are costume heavy and they can do the work. The costumes do a lot of the work, if only just to get you into the mindset of this other person. I mean, like, I've heard actors on television shows be like, you know, I have to wait to be the character until they finish my makeup. And then I look at myself and I'm like, okay, now I can do it. And it's like crazy.
Like on stage, like people will be like, and like then go on stage and be a character, and like their character is not, does not have the flu, and then they get off stage and immediately they're sick again. And it's just like, really, I don't know, it's really fascinating to me.
Oh, adrenaline's the best drug of them all. Are you kidding me? Yeah. You get on stage, you could be like, yeah, fully flued up. And then you go up and you're like, ha, 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 I'm the best. Who's laughing at me? Everybody loves me. See you later, guys. And you get off stage and you're like, oh, God. Oh, yeah. Oof.
Yep.
Love that for sure. Yeah, it makes me think of, like, you know, just developing the way that you look at yourself. Like, I'm not a Freud person exactly, but I do think there's some validity to, like, the id, the ego, and the superego. Like, you know, the id being like, you know, the part of me that's like, yeah, I'm gonna have some chocolate. Eat it now. Yeah. And then there's the super ego who's like, it's really not good for you. You probably shouldn't have it. You should quit sugar as on the whole. And then the ego who's sort of in between the two of them, who's like, okay, I hear what you're saying. Yeah, I get that you want chocolate. I get that you want us to quit. We're not gonna quit, but we're not gonna have chocolate right now. What do you guys think? Okay, good. Sounds good. Like, I feel like for sure there's definitely, for me at least, three solid, like, voices in there moving things around, trying to make decisions. Yeah. Like, the id's all about emotions. You know, like, when I'm angry, it's all like, yeah, let's punch something. What's happening? Ah! You know, and, like, I'm, you know, the logical part of my brain is like, you know, I see that you're angry and you probably shouldn't do or say anything that that you're thinking right now, because that's not going to end well. So, you know what I mean? Like, so there's all sorts of different parts of me. I think about that all the time. And to be honest, if not for the, you know, psychologists that have mentioned such things, and even acting training like you're talking about with the mask and developing characters and stuff, I'd probably think I was crazy. But the fact that there's so many people around me that also have this connection to sort of the multiple sides of themselves, it's like, okay, cool, great. I'm not the only one.
Yeah. But it's crazy anyway.
Yeah, right. Oh man, I'd rather be crazy. I think it's a good path. It seems right for me. I've always thought I was going to go down a rabbit hole and end up in a straitjacket someday. Who knows how it'll go? We'll see. I mean that in the most fun way about myself, I promise. So final question for you. Thank you, Mark, by the way, for chatting with me for so long and sharing. What is any advice that you have for other people who want to do performance like you do? How do they get into it, and how do they make it happen?
Just do it. really the only reason that I am where I am is because I stuck around long enough. Like, I think literally that's the only reason. Just, like, keep doing it. Like, find the thing you like to do. Keep doing it, and wait until everyone else leaves, and then you're the best. but like, it's just it's really like, I am a firm believer that there is talent is not a thing that exists. That is a made up concept. Like, in its skill is not a thing, you know, except for, like, you know, there's some people who are more predisposed to being, you know, marathon runners or whatever. But I think it's like, as far as like acting or playing an instrument or writing or singing or whatever you like to do, the only reason people are good at it is because they've spent a lot of time at it. My daughter is 13, almost 13. She's an incredibly good artist right now, I think. And she gets furious when her friends are like, oh my god, you're such a good artist, like, you draw, like, you have so much talent. She's like, no, I draw 4 to 8 hours a day every single day because I like it. But like, putting in those hours is the only way to do it. And even like directed practice, or what's the term, like the practice directed towards doing the thing as good as possible, is going to shorten that time. But like, I didn't have that. I didn't really do that. Like, I did my best, but just a matter of like doing your 10,000, 100,000 hours and just keeping at it. And if you don't like it, you don't have to do it anymore. Like, sunk cost is a terrible thing. Like, if you're especially like, oh man, like, if you're in some sort of relationship, like an improv troupe or whatever. And like, oh, we've been together for 5 years and everyone hates each other and I don't like the work we're doing, but I put 5 years in, so I have to keep doing it. You don't have to. Do what you like. Or like, I don't like writing anymore. I'm going to be a dancer. Great. You don't have to do it. You do what you like. But if you want to get good at something, put in the hours. And if you just want to do something for fun, that is totally fine too. You don't have to be one of the things that like has been enraging me more and more over the last couple of years is like the idea that you have to hustle or make your hobby something that you become great at or can make money at. If you just like doing theater just to like be on stage and be dumb, like you don't have to be good. No, I don't care if you're good. Most people don't care if you're good. If there's something that you like, that you really enjoy, that you really think you are good at and nobody agrees, fuck them. Do the thing that you like.
Yeah.
Draw your webcomic, play your, you know, banjo or whatever. Like you do it because you like it, and if someone else likes it, that is a bonus. If you get good at it, that is a bonus. If you get paid for it, that is a super bonus. But do what you like. You got, I don't know, you got, you know, up to 80 years left. That's not a lot of time. Do what you like and fuck everyone else.
Right.
And be nice to people.
That's a good one.
Don't be a dick.
Yeah, I mean, in the interest of doing what you like, you know, be nice to people because they're trying to figure out what they like too.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always nice. And it's nice to be around people who are nice. And especially if you're someone who has been around a while that other new people come in and see, like, be nice to new people, be nice to people you don't know, be nice to people who can't, most importantly, be nice to people who can't get you anything. Like that's the number one. Just do that. Put in the hours, and whenever people ask me for advice like that for improv, I'm just like, my two rules are like, I was not good for a long time. You don't have to be good. Show up on time and don't be a pain in the ass, and that will get you 90% of the way. Those are the only two rules. And have a side job because you're not going to get rich doing improv.
I'm going to say show up on time and don't be a pain in the ass could get you like a full film career. Like, yeah, that's
all you got to do. That'll put you above 90% of people.
It really will. It really will. It's crazy how those two things are so rare. Oh my God. I can't tell. Honest to goodness, when I had the sketch show, the people that would show up on time for the audition and be like, oh, they're the first three in.
Yep.
I don't care if they're the worst. I'll put them in. I'll find them a role. I'll teach them how to be better.
Yeah. You can always teach people. You can always direct people. You can't make people not be the way they are.
Yeah. That's why I like in auditions for stuff, like for film or commercials, I like when the people who are going to be making it are there because I can get anyone to like me, you know? Mm. So I'm like, hey, you want to hang out with me? You know, you do. I'm the best. And then they're like, that's true. There might be plenty more attractive people or people who are, you know, more talented, but I'm a fun time. And they have to spend 6 months with somebody. That's me.
Right.
Fun time, Amy. Oh, man. So fun. Thank you so much for chatting with me and sharing your story and excellent advice.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.